This is The 10th Voice, Kansas City's gay and lesbian radio magazine.
ISIS has systematically murdered people by...
The 10th Voice, because you refuse to be silent.
Welcome to The 10th Voice. I'm your host, Elizabeth Anderson, and this is the Sandra Moran Alphabet Soup Radio Book Club. I love that name. And earlier this morning, I posted on the event page a post, and it began, "There's a beautiful, sparkly unicorn in the middle of the room." And that, of course, is Sandra, who is supposed to be hosting this show. And unfortunately, she's not with us. I have a feeling radio waves go into the air, and I have a feeling that she's listening. So we will try to do right by her. And we are going to be joined later in the show by authors Anne McMahon and Mary Ann K. Martin. And I'm about to do the news, but in the meantime, I want to introduce our producer, sound engineer, who's been with the shows for 27 years now, Linda Wilson.
Good afternoon, Elizabeth.
And I also want to introduce our
special guest. And our special guest today is Sandra's wife, Cheryl Pletcher.
Hi, Elizabeth. Thanks for including me. It's a real honor to be here on Sandra's show.
And we're delighted to have you.
Thank you.
So let's start out with the news. And it's a little different today. It's not national, international LGBT news. It's entertainment news. The Golden Globes nominations are newly out, and LGBT film shows and people made a strong showing. Carol, which is based on the novel that we're discussing today, The Price of Salt, is up for Best Motion Picture Drama, Best Director, Todd Haynes, Best Actress, Rooney Mara and Cate Blanchett, and Best Score. Another film newly out, The Danish Girl, is up for Alicia Vikander and Eddie Redmayne, who was nominated for Best Actor, playing a transgender woman. Lily Tomlin, I think everybody knows her, is up for Best Actress in a Motion Picture, and that's for Grandma, and also for her role in Netflix's Grace and Frankie. If you haven't seen Jane Fonda and Lily Tomlin in Grace and Frankie, I urge you to do so, and it has been renewed for a second season. The lesbian writer Emma Donahue was nominated for Best Screenplay for Room. And that is a harrowing novel. I did read it. It's a beautiful novel, well written. I've read about three of her books and can highly recommend Emma Donahue. Congratulations to her. And there were other awards as well, including Viola Davis, who was nominated for her queer How to Get Away with Murder character, Uzo Aduba for her Orange is the New Black role, and Queen Latifah, who is taking on Lady Gaga for Best Actress in a Limited Series. Now, as for books you should read, I went to Lambda Literary, and these are a few books from this year. Under the Udala Trees by Chinelo Okparanta, and Lambda Literary Review says that readers will be reminded of Jeanette Winterson's debut novel, Oranges Are Not the Only Fruit, which paired a young lesbian's coming of age with her mother's stringent religious judgments and abuses. So that sounds like a very interesting book. Another book that is being featured on Sandra's show, she picked it, and we'll be discussing it, is LaShonda Catrice Barnett's Jam on the Vine. And I've already asked two panelists onto that show. Annette Billings, I think people know her from Maria Vasquez Boyd's show, from Woman Song and from The 10th Voice. She is a poet, and she is going to join Miguel Morales. And that book, the decisions Barnett's characters make are difficult. The world in which they love and breathe is perilous. Yet readers turn the pages of Jam with reassurance that there is no sweet without bitter. There are no victims in Jam on the Vine. There is a vibrant cast making mistakes, facing injustice, and falling in love. And I was very excited when Sandra picked this book, and I'm looking forward to it. Another book, this is by Jeanette Winterson, not like her book, but it is her book, is The Gap of Time. And I won't say anything about this because anyone who knows Jeanette Winterson is probably going to go Google The Gap of Time and look it up. Another book by Lillian Faderman, and she is a historical writer. She writes of lesbian history. She wrote The Gay Revolution, The Story of the Struggle. Faderman has plumbed the archives of libraries, newspapers, legislative bodies, lesbian and gay organizations, police files, and also interviewed more than 100 activists and others to get this meticulously researched book to us. And Cheryl and I were talking about Sandra having picked out, and I put them on the event site, and I'll put them on the 10th Voice page, book titles from the entire LGBTQ alphabet for the next 9 months. And I said, I have an idea what she was going for, and when I see a book and I feel, oh, she would have picked this one, then I'm going to add it. Lillian Faderman's book, there's no question in my mind, is a book she would have added. I heard Lillian speak at UMKC in the 90s, and she is a wonderful researcher, and she will have turned up terrific facts from the archives of our community. So let's hear some music, and let's get Anne McMahon and Marianne K. Martin on the line.
Well, this is Linda, and I picked the music today, and I just wanted to say, knowing yours and Sandra's relationship, I think this is a perfect song. You got a friend. I mean, I heard this when I was, like, first coming out, and I don't know, it really touches your heart. And I thought it was very appropriate, too, because Carole King just won the presidential award, and so I think it's a good song to play today for Sandra and for you, everything. Carole King, go ahead.
I also wanted to say that I've been talking to Cheryl, and I knew that she and Sandra were very great friends, but having talked to Cheryl, I see even better why that's true.
And this song just says it all about being friends.
Welcome back to the Sandra Moran Alphabet Soup Radio Book Club, and I'm your host, Elizabeth Anderson, and I am joined today, as I said before, by Linda Wilson, our sound engineer and producer, and our special guest. I want to welcome her again, Sandra's wife, Cheryl Pletcher.
Thank you, Elizabeth.
And we have two more guests, I hope, on the phone. We have authors. Anne McMahon, are you there?
I am here.
Ooh, okay. Let's try for Marianne K. Martin.
Yes, I'm here.
All right. We have success. I think we can start a discussion. So what I thought we would do is talk first about your backgrounds, you know, something about your literary backgrounds, and then I'll ask you how you collaborated, each of you, with Sandra. So, Anne, would you like to go first and talk about your background, books you've written, and so on?
Well, sure. I came to writing a bit later in life, actually a lot later in life. Published my first book in 2011, which seems like five lifetimes ago, a novel called Jericho, and that quickly followed with several other novels and collections of stories. And I met Sandra in 2013. She reached out to me as an author and was seeking advice about how to get her first novel, Letters Never Sent, published. And we became fast friends and writing colleagues from that moment on.
And you two, and I believe some others too, including Lynn Ames, tended to cut up during Golden Crown literary conferences. Is this true?
Yeah. I'm actually surprised they didn't make us sit at a table out in the hallway.
But you were during the autograph signing session.
Well, I meant during the actual conference activities. We did have a tendency to misbehave.
Yes, I believe I saw some of that. So, Marianne, let me ask you how you got into writing and how you collaborated with Sandra.
Okay, well, first, I never really intended to be a published author. I had other careers going on, teaching and and coaching, and came back to writing more or less as therapy because, you know, as a public school teacher, you really don't have that extra money for therapy. So it became my therapy. And eventually did get published and now have, like, I think 10 novels to my name and working on another. And I'm part owner of Bywater Books, a publishing company. And I met Sandra also through GCLS. And we started talking, just sitting at a table talking, and found ourselves sneaking away for time just to sit and talk. Instead of getting in trouble like some people, we were sneaking off trying to find some sane time. And I ended up collaborating with her when I was asked to do the keynote speech for the music festival, National Women's Music Festival, and some panels and presentations at that that year. And I started thinking, well, one of the things I wanted to do was to start getting some kind of a project together to for our history of our literature and everything. And I started talking with Sandra about that, and I said, would you be willing to work with me on that for the festival? And she said, it took her a half an hour to check her schedule, and she came back and said, I am there. And so that started it. From then, we worked a lot on that project, and it's known now as the Lesbian Literature Legacy Project, and I will carry that further.
And Sandra believed very much in how things are interconnected, and I want to point out that our producer, Linda Wilson, is president of the board of National Women's Music Festival, and she was there. I'm a house manager of the day stage, and I was at that 2014 festival in Madison. Unfortunately, I did not get to hear either of you because I was busy house managing, and I don't think Linda did either.
I didn't get to hear it, and I was so sorry after I met Sandra many months later that I didn't take the advantage of the situation and make time to go see him, because I really love to read, too, and I would have loved to hear that talk about the history of lesbian literature. Mm-hmm. It would have been great.
But I was fortunate in November, Sandra spoke on it at UMKC, and again, interconnected. Cheryl, you were on the video camera, is that correct?
I was. I recorded that, yes.
And then I heard her again give the talk in Topeka. And I think that's a wonderful segue into the book that we're discussing, Patricia Highsmith's The Price of Salt. I wonder, Marianne, if you'd give a little background on what was going on in the 50s and why this book was so important at that time.
Yeah, because Marianne, you were in college then, right? Oh, you are so good.
Oh, she's begun. It's on now. Marianne, go right ahead.
Good luck, Marianne.
Well, one of the things that, you know, Sandra and I both enjoyed was, you know, finding out what was going on and how during those decades and how it affected the literature that was coming out of that time. And a number of things were very apparent, one being that homosexuality was illegal up until 1973. And during that time, you could be arrested and thrown in jail for 10 years, or even more popular solution to our society's problem with us was to put us in institutions. And so with those as a background, those solutions to us being society's solution, you know, we were really, I don't know what the word would be, but, you know, honored, I guess, to have any kind of literature coming out of those times. And, of course, many of them wrote under an assumed name, which Patricia Highsmith did as Claire Morgan. But, you know, the danger not just to your social life and everything, but to your career. And she wanted to have a career as a mystery writer, and did have a good start on her career. And then she wrote this book, Price of Salt, which at that time was it was in danger of being banned, for one thing, because of the Obscene Act, which the Obscene Publications Act, which wasn't, it was in place until like 1959. So, you know, I'm surprised that book didn't get banned. And probably the only reason it didn't was because there still was that, you know, giving up of something to have
they
the
had to be punished.
You want. You know, so as long as that was still present in the ending of the book, I suppose they let it go. But yeah, there was a lot of danger, not just to your own happiness, but also to your careers during that time.
And
can I ask a question?
Absolutely.
Marianne? One question that I have about it, as much reading as I've done about how Patricia Highsmith ended up writing this story, and it was based on a personal experience that she actually had as a seasonal worker in a Bloomingdale's in New York City. What actually motivated her to write the novel and publish it when, for so much of her life, she seemed to work really hard to distance herself from the book?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she did. Well, she had an encounter, an affair, a lover who actually went through this with losing her child and, you know, having the detective follow her all over the world and, you know, tape and everything. So this actually happened. This was much of her life in this book. And I think part of it was this, you know, she had a detachment for many reasons, to save a career, to have a career. So the detachment comes out in her writing in a lot of ways. But I think this was her rage. I think this was her way of saying, you know, I've got to get this out somehow, and this is how I do it. Even if I can't put my name to it, and I won't claim it, it's still her way of getting that part of her rage out somehow. Rather than, and I guess according to a lot of interviews and articles that I've read, she took it out in other ways too. But this was just, I think, one of her. It was the only book she ever wrote like this.
She was a voracious writer. What, 40, 50 books?
Yeah,
easily. And she was always very clear later in interviews when the book came out under her own name that she did not want to be identified as a lesbian author.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. She hated labels and blamed a lot of the labelism on Americans because we love our labels so much.
And I have a question. This is Elizabeth. It's true, too, that many of the lesbian novels in the 50s were pulp fiction, many written by men. Isn't that correct?
Yeah. Well, you can tell by the covers.
Yes. Those very lurid.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And
well, the original cover for The Price of Salt, you know, had, you know, it sort of evoked all of those same tropes, you know, the sort of young, innocent looking woman in the foreground and the slightly almost menacing looking Carol bending over her with a lighted cigarette, you know, and then the figure of a man in a distance who appears to be rushing in, probably to save the young woman.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yep.
And this is Elizabeth again. Anne, you would know something about covers, wouldn't you?
Yeah. Well, maybe just a little. Yeah, it's true that in addition to my work as an author, I'm also a cover designer and have worked fairly extensively in that. And one of the it's interesting to kind of bring this aspect of this particular book and this whole genre of these lesbian-themed pulp fiction books up in that context, because part of what I really endeavor to do in the way I approach cover design now for books written in our literature is avoid all of those. I mean, you know, I try to give them, for lack of better term, as mainstream an appearance as possible. And I do that intentionally and by design.
And very well, I must add.
yes, I would certainly agree with that.
This is Cheryl. I would, too. Anne did all the covers for Sandra's books, including the book that will come out in April called State of Grace.
Well, I think we have to take a break to do a station announcement. You two won't go away, will you?
No, I heard we were having appetizers.
Yes, yes, we'll be mailing them any minute.
Okay.
ISIS has systematically murdered people by pushing them off the rooftops of buildings, by stoning people to death, by shooting people. And more recently, we've been hearing stories from colleagues in Iraq and Syria that some ISIS agents have actually been tying weights around the neck.
This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Ireland bans bias against queer school teachers, Austrian kids sue for their parents' marriage rights, and Syrian refugees are not all created equal. Those stories and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
This Way Out airs 2 p.m. Saturdays, right after the 10th Voice.
In 2015, women are still being accused of witchcraft. How can this be? Listen to Wings Saturday afternoon at 2:30.
And this is the 10th Voice, the Sandra Moran Alphabet Soup Radio Book Club. And I want to remind everyone that Sandra was a local author, a published award-winning author. And she was going to host this show, but tragically she passed November 7th. And we will be discussing a book each second Saturday of the month. And today's book is Patricia Highsmith, The Price of Salt, a Lesbian Classic. And I'm joined by Linda Wilson, Cheryl Pletcher, Ann McMahon, and Mary Ann K. Martin. So welcome back, you two who are on the phone.
Hi.
Thank you, Mom.
And let's talk a little about the actual novel. Let me ask you a question. Are there any other books that even come close to the feelings that Highsmith evokes in The Price of Salt from that time period? Mary Ann?
Well, yes. Mary Jane Meeker's Spring Fire was in 52 as well. But it was, I don't know how to compare it in a sense. There's still some detachment, you know, there was still some of that detachment. And I think that was probably true of the era as much. You don't get into an emotional character involvement with each other where you're really seeing a lot of emotion, I don't think, until you get into the 60s with probably Desert of the Heart,
Jane Rule.
Yeah. And then even further than that, getting into the later 60s with Patience and Sarah, where you really get a lot of emotion and you really get in touch with those feelings and everything. And I think you just still see, in the 50s, you still see that kind of detachment. I don't know if it was their fear of letting that out, or fear that it wouldn't be published if they gave that kind of emotion to their characters.
And this is Elizabeth. I find it interesting that there's a parallel in film. I've worked on our LGBT film festival for 15 years, and you mentioned Desert Hearts, and that was one of the films where the emotions were freely stated. And before that, it seemed so often, it turned out they weren't lovers, they were friends, someone had to die, someone had to get, sick or something. And I think Desert Hearts, both in book and film, were pivotal.
It, like this book, though, I think had a somewhat ambiguous ending, which I guess, particularly for The Price of Salt, at the time, people took to be heroic, almost celebratory, because neither of the women died or ended up institutionalized or got pushed into unhappy marriages. And I think, you know, Desert Hearts, Desert of the Heart, had almost that same sort of ambiguity at the end. I mean, you were left with the sense that these two women might try to make a life together, but it was really unclear how that would happen or how it would work.
Right. Well, Elizabeth, your point about the movie versus the book, the book itself really didn't, it was more a psychological study, and in keeping with that ambiguity, where there wasn't as much emotion, but the movie, you know, in order for the movie to really be popular, I think they had to go to the emotional. You know, you couldn't go into their heads. You had to hear and see what they were doing. And so, and I think this will be interesting to see what they do with Carol with the movie. Are you going to see more emotion from those characters in the movie?
I haven't seen the film, but a lot of the sort of advanced reviews of it I've read have talked about how the producer and the director and the screenwriter, Phyllis Nagy, made an effort to really humanize the character of Carol Aird more than she really was in the novel. Because, you know, Highsmith really did have this remarkable detachment from the principal characters in the book. It was, reading the book is almost like a voyeuristic experience. You really, at least I did, I almost felt like that kind of creepy man, you know, who Carol's husband hired to follow them, you know, because you were constantly sort of watching them both from a distance, and you never really got a clear sense, especially of Carol's interior life. And I think that they changed that in the film.
This is Elizabeth, and the word that kept coming to my mind was brittle. Carol would put Therese to bed, almost as if she was a child. And when Therese would ask a perfectly good question about their relationship, Carol would distance her in almost every case. This question is for both of you, and you could talk first, but did you find these characters believable and likable?
I found them to be believable, and I think that's one of the things to me that really makes this a timeless work of fiction. You know, the fact that she really was able to write about real women who are not perfect and who don't always behave in heroic or even especially enviable ways. I mean, Carol makes what by any rubric would be a horrible choice at the end of this book. You know, is it heroic for a woman to give up her child, you know, to indulge her passion for a younger woman? I don't really know the answer to that. But did I care about them? No, not very much. You know, the experience of reading the book for me was one of constant amazement that I was caught up in the story and felt really compelled to keep reading it just because Highsmith is such a masterful storyteller. But I really didn't like either of the women much at all.
Marianne, what about you?
I understand a lot of what Anne was saying too. Those feelings of detachment really, and the voyeurism too, of watching something happen and not being able to affect it in any way. And yet, I kept going back to the craft because kept you engaged. She did keep you engaged, and she is a master at that. And I think given the time, and here's my going back to the history that this was written in and the remarkable achievement that she really did, you know, get this book published, didn't get it banned, and the fact that she was able to get this story out there. And I cared about that part of it, I guess, as much as anything. And I wonder if I would feel differently reading it at the time, if I had read it in the 50s versus reading it now or even when I first read it, you know, years ago. I'm wondering if my whole take on it would have been much different, and I would have been more engaged and more astounded.
You know what I wonder about that, Marianne, too, because that occurred to me a lot, too. Like, what would the experience of reading this book in 1952 have been like? And one of the things I noticed about the book while I was reading it was how relatively blasé Therese was about the discovery of her own homosexuality. I mean, it wasn't even a blip on the radar for her. You know, and that seemed to really strain credibility for me. But, you know, but again, I mean, for today, it makes complete sense. I mean, I have an easy time imagining, you know, that a woman could come to that level of self-understanding today and not have it be, you know, wholly disruptive. But it was really hard to imagine that that could be the experience of someone in 1952, where she develops this passionate obsession with an older woman and just kind of goes, oh, well, okay, yeah, I'm going to do this.
This is Elizabeth. For me, a factor was that she had no real family, and so she didn't have to worry about their reaction to her falling in love with a woman. She had Richard, but obviously she wasn't caught up with him, and she had some coworkers, but she really had relatively few friends and not much family. So I think that may have made it easier for her to just go with her feelings.
You know, if you think about sort of iconic works of American literature, the character of Therese to me is a whole lot, you're going to laugh at this, is a whole lot like Sister Carrie, you know, in Theodore Dreiser's novel.
Yeah.
This, you know, this woman who just sort of floats along the surface of, you know, more or less of whatever passes in front of her.
And I think that's one of the things that bothered me about her is her passivity. Even when Carol goes back to New York, she just kind of drifts around to a hotel and then to a rooming house. And she doesn't. And now, I understand not having a plan. I have frequently not had a plan, but she doesn't seem to want one.
Didn't you all find the way Patricia Highsmith used locations, like geographic locations in the book, to just be fascinating? The way Carol and Therese related to each other when they were in New York City was completely different than when they got in the car and took off on that road trip west.
Well, and Waterloo turned out to be their Waterloo.
Correct. And she picked all of these off-the-beaten-path, incredibly bizarre places.
I've never even heard of Lusk.
Yeah, it was. I think that was one of the most masterful aspects of the book.
Mm-hmm. And I really totally enjoyed her way of using that trip to show the growth in Tress, especially in Tress, but seeing the difference in their relationship and how just starting to read the map and deciding where to stop and how far to go, and those types of things, she began to take some control, and she began to make some decisions, and Carol began to give up those.
I think those are perfect metaphors for exactly what was happening with a relationship dynamic between those two women, and that's one of the things that Highsmith was just so good at in all of her books.
Well, exactly.
If you two don't mind, we're going to take another break for an announcement, and we're coming back. So, everyone, we're discussing The Price of Salt by Patricia Highsmith with Ann McMahon and Marianne K. Martin.
KKFI Holiday Auction is December the 12th at Ollie's Local, 31st and Gillum Road, 6 to 10 p.m. with live and silent auctions, raffles, and live entertainment from Jessica Page, The Match Sellers, Ivory Black, and Loaded Goat. Auction packages include a weekend at Table Rock Lake, nights at the Aladdin Hotel or the Hotel Phillips, shows in Branson, the Steel Drivers at Folly Theater, shows at the Riot Room, and vinyl packages. KKFI's Holiday Auction is December the 12th, Ollie's Local, 31st and Gillum, 6 to 10 p.m.
Michael, my support group wants to know, what's on the next Arts Magazine show?
Time to don your gay apparel, Governor, as the Kansas City Women's Chorus will join us and they'll talk about their upcoming holiday concert. Then later, folks from Mammoth Productions will be here, and they'll tell us about their new show, Christmas Ain't a Drag.
Well, I can dig that, men. That's Monday at noon, Arts Magazine Show.
This is Elizabeth Anderson, your host for the Sandra Moran Alphabet Soup Radio Book Club on the 10th Voice. And we're talking about Patricia Highsmith's The Price of Salt. One question that I want to raise now is we've talked about the setting and how it's almost a character, New York and Iowa and Salt Lake City. One of the things I found fascinating about the book, and as a modern reader, it almost took me out of the book at times, was how cigarettes were another character.
And alcohol.
And alcohol. And also when that detective, how the heck did he trail them? Because they took off at 3 a.m. at one point. And I kept thinking, oh, he had a GPS. And I went, oh, wait, it's 1952. So what did you think about those period details? Anne?
I thought they were fascinating, and you're right. They did sort of, I think they simultaneously pulled you up by the short hairs, but then they pushed you back in time so that it forced you to think more appropriately about the ways things actually were unfolding. You mean like when they would find the dictaphone hidden in the room and the cord was run underneath the wall-to-wall carpet?
It's true. Marianne, what about you?
Yes, I know that, you know, a lot of times now you look at modern movies and modern books and everything and you say, okay, the political correct thing or the socially correct thing is to, you know, you don't show people smoking anymore, you don't show them, you know, downing drink after drink and so on. But this really was so significant at the time that, you know, they pointed out even with the drinking, you know, the brandy made her depressed. This, you know, they were showing what this did to them, how they used it. Smoking was, in a sense, during that time, a freedom for women. You know, women were, you know, starting to do this as a regular habit because they could now. And, you know, so you are thrown back into that time and you're supposed to be, viewing what is happening through what is happening at the time. And I think she did that so well, so really well. You really, I could almost smell the smoke in the room, you know, reading the book.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I also was thinking, what would younger readers today who have cell phones and who don't have a landline think of a time when you had to make a plan to each be at a phone? And you might have to wait to have a call put through. Mm-hmm. I actually am old enough, yes, okay, I'm turning 64, that I remember party lines. And
I do too. Yeah. I do too.
I actually worked on a switchboard where I had to plug in the cords.
Yeah. Whoa. Yeah.
I'm old.
Okay, Linda wins that one.
Yeah.
What about writing letters?
Right.
You know, how they would arrange to get their mail, you know, in the next city where they knew they were going to be, and they'd have to write letters to each other or postcards and wait for responses.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's true.
Right. The lapse of time. Yeah, the lapse of time between things and being able to get messages and information back and forth and how time-consuming that was.
Well, and there's a scene where they're trying to burn the evidence, and I thought, I couldn't even picture what it was exactly that they were holding. And they finally threw it in the river. But, you know, some of this technology that was cutting edge at the time and the detective had it is so old that I don't know what it was.
Yeah.
Well, there were a lot of elements in the, you know, she wrote, I believe before this book, Strangers on a Train, which Alfred Hitchcock produced.
Right.
And it's easy to see how her style of storytelling would adapt so naturally to his type of filmmaking because of all the elements we just discussed.
Well, mm-hmm. and basically what you're talking about now, this is Elizabeth, is pacing. And I want to mention that we did get some responses from friends on Facebook who have seen the film Carol. And so first, I want to ask each of you why you think the film was retitled The Price of Salt, and what does The Price of Salt mean? Why was it retitled to Carol? Marianne, you want to go first?
Yeah, I think it's it is a sign of the time. It's easy, it's quick, it points direction to the main character. It's easy to advertise. The Price of Salt, you have to think about the title. You have to think about it. You have to fit it into the story. Once you get into the story, you have to understand it. And I think it's a marketing, you know, it's an easy marketing. To me, The Price of Salt, I know later she even talked about it in an interview about it being biblical, you know, that once the salt is gone, how do you get it back? And if it's gone, the earth is not worth anything. You know, which was her metaphor, of course, for herself. You know, once I lose who I am, how do I ever get it back? And I'm worthless without it.
Good point. Anne, any thoughts?
Same thing. You know, to me, it's a perfect metaphor for how much is a person willing to give up to buy their happiness. And right. I think that's how the metaphor of the price of salt relates to the story. And I agree with Marianne. I think calling the film Carol is a sort of, although I wasn't this book, when it was released in Britain, wasn't it released under the title Carol?
I don't think I know.
I think it was. Well, anyway, I think it sort of humanizes the story. It focuses attention like a laser beam on Kate Blanchett, and why right. would you not want to do that, you know, since this mm-hmm. is a total star vehicle for her.
Well, and I have one real quick question for Cheryl before we turn to the film, and that was, you were doing the video for Sandra's presentation on lesbian literature legacy. What was your reaction as you heard her speak on the evolution of literature?
Wow, that's a loaded question, Elizabeth.
You can say anything. It's nice and broad.
I know. Thank you for that. I guess it's interesting for me because as you know, I was 25 years old before I tuned in to the fact that I was a lesbian. And so I was already working and kind of in the world and then, of course, trying to hide myself. And so I hadn't spent any time thinking about how all this transpired. And it was so fascinating to be around Sandra because Sandra did do a lot. Although she wrote a lot of historical fiction, she was a historian. And it was fascinating for me to be able to understand how lesbian literature had transpired over time and to understand that from her perspective. So it was a great learning experience.
Oh, and I admired Sandra's dedication to her research. She wanted to nail down every detail for Letters Never Sent. I understand she went to Chicago. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah. Yes, we did for that book. We went and actually picked out where the characters would live and, you know, so that she had a real sense of that.
That's great. Wonderful.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk a little about the film. And I had put a call out on Facebook on the event page for people who might have seen it. And we got two wonderful responses. One is from Laura Nastro. And she said she saw it this very morning. The adaption was handled very well and remained faithful to Highsmith's book with minor adjustments, and she felt they were very effective. The acting was fabulous. Rooney Mara was extraordinary, which is probably why she's up for a Golden Globe. The photography was exquisite. The movie conveyed a sense of time and place perfectly. I never thought the movie dragged, and I thought the ending was exactly as it should be. And she said she'd be listening to the show, so thank you so much, Laura. And then we also heard from, and I hope I pronounced the name right, Nancy. Do either of you know Nancy Heredia? Does anybody know? Okay. Well, thank you, Nancy. She writes, Carol is cinematic perfection, hitting all the right notes, faithful to the book and then some. The casting is perfect. Both Rooney and Kate are pitch perfect as if born to play these roles. Todd's direction is stellar. The costumes, the score, and the cinematography are outstanding. Have seen it twice, and I believe it is a classic. And Ula Ho says, have seen it, and she'll see it again soon. And I want to mention for local listeners here in Kansas City that I don't know if it's going to be at other theaters, but it's going to be at the Tivoli opening on Christmas Day for anyone that wants to see it. So are you two going to go, Marianne and Anne, in your respective communities?
Yeah,
oh,
I'd love to see it.
Was this year, yeah.
And one of the things I've noticed being on the local film festival is people say, well, there need to be more lesbian films. And I know there are filmmakers like Nicole Kahn who are working very hard at getting those films made. But it's expensive and it's difficult. Yeah. And lesbian filmmakers don't always have the support of, say, Hollywood.
Oh, yeah, just women in general don't get the support mm-hmm. that men do in making films. Or and, anything.
And that was Linda, who...
I have to butt in every now and then.
And we welcome that. But one of the things that I have noticed is that if a film like Carol gets made and there aren't butts in the seat, then there aren't going to be more of those films. And so I would recommend anyone who's listening to our discussion on The Price of Salt and our discussion of LGBTQ literature that you also support the films as they're made, because these films are often adaptations of books, and so you're helping both genres. Any reactions to that, Marianne or Anne?
Yeah, this is Marianne. Yeah, you're spot on. That's exactly what fuels the whole enterprise is butts in the seat. We have to go see these things. You know, write reviews afterwards. Tell other people. Talk to people about it and get them interested. And I think, historically, I think this is helping our own community as well.
I agree.
And one of the things I'm looking forward to in the film is when I heard that Kate Blanchett had been cast, I thought, oh, my God, she's perfect. You know, I hadn't seen a trailer, nothing, but I just thought.
She is perfect. Everything about her is perfect. She's perfect physically. She's perfect in terms of her. You know, she's kind of a, again, she's kind of like a Hitchcock actress.
Mm-hmm. She is.
I mean, if you think about the women he always cast in his movies, icy, unobtainable blondes.
You're absolutely correct.
Yeah, very good point, Anne.
And one of the things, too, about the film, and I'm delighted by this, is it is getting broad distribution. It's rolling out slowly, but it is and especially with the awards as they're acquiring the Golden Globes, the Screen Actors Guild, and also it's expected to pick up Academy Award nominations. I think it's going to linger in theaters. It's going to get wide play and word of mouth. On Rotten Tomatoes, it's 94%, and that's a very, very high score.
Wow. That's great.
Well, I want to thank both of you for participating in this inaugural show. This is the first book club.
Oh, I'm thrilled to be here.
Yeah, I'm honored. I'm honored to be on here and Elizabeth and Linda, thank you so much for keeping this going, keeping this true to Sandra's vision. We appreciate that so much.
Absolutely. I second that.
And Cheryl, I would love to hear your opinion on this, but she felt strongly that good books, good writing, it needs to be celebrated and talked about. Cheryl?
Yes, I guess I wanted to triple the thank you, Elizabeth and Linda, to keeping this going for Sandra. I'll try not to get too emotional here, but this meant so much to her. She was so excited about this radio show. She felt, and not for herself, as anybody who knows Sandra would know, she didn't do anything for herself. It wasn't about herself. It was about the ability to really raise the bar on the women's the lesbian literature and women's literature in general, but especially lesbian literature, and to try to help promote that. So thanks to you both for keeping her spirit alive here.
I'm happy to be part of it. Elizabeth's really doing all the work, and she's really gone to the maximum to make the show happen. Elizabeth, you did a great job.
Thank you. When I was talking to Sandra about the show, she said, it'll be your show. And I said, oh, no, it won't. It absolutely will not. And she knew I meant it. It is Sandra's show, and I'm very happy to host it. And one of the things that told me she was so excited about it was she kept dinging me at work with messages saying, what about this author? What about this guest? What do you think about this theme? And I would say, Sandra, I'm at work. Sandra, at work.
Sandra, get off the elliptical.
Yeah. Anyone who knows Sandra knows that was true. But no, she was really pumped about this show. And
very much so.
Happy that it was going to continue. So thank you all for listening.
Oh, you're so welcome. I'm thrilled to be here.
Thank you. Yes, thank you so much.
And I want to mention next month's book. It is on our event page. I'm going to put it every place I can think about it. Sandra and George Hodgman did a joint Rainy Day Books event here in Kansas City on his book, Bettyville, a Random House book, and her book, All We Lack, with Bedazzled. And George is going to be featured on January 9th. He has agreed to participate. We're very excited. His book is just a riveting account of his coming from New York City back home to Missouri to deal with an aged mother. And we've got some exciting panelists. One I want to mention right now is R.E. Bradshaw, an author who will have a book out later this month on a very, very similar theme. And I think it's going to be a fascinating discussion. So please stay tuned to This Way Out and Wings and Every Woman.